It's good to see everyone here this morning. Appreciate your presence. If you have your New Testaments with you, you can turn to Philippians chapter 4, verses 10 through 13. Here the Apostle Paul says, "But I rejoiced in the Lord greatly, and now at last you have revived your concern for me. Indeed, you were concerned before, but you lacked opportunity. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. I know how to get along with humble means, and I also know how to live in prosperity. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of being filled and going hungry, both of having abundance and suffering need. I can do all things through Him who strengthens me." The Apostle Paul also told the young man Timothy in the book of 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 6 that godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. Contentment is something that is greatly desired by man, and the lack of contentment is often expressed in society, and we feel the very consequences of the fact that man strives for but does not gain that sense. The Cambridge English Dictionary defines content as being pleased with your situation and not hoping for a change or an improvement. And so that's an important definition. The definition of content is, because if you look up contentment, most dictionaries simply define it as being content. So if you're going to talk about contentment, but I think the important thing here and the point for the lesson, and I looked in my records and so forth, and some of you that really remember things and even note them in your Bible say, "Well, Mike has preached this sermon before." So I'm going to assure you, I have not. I went and checked. I've preached three other sermons on contentment in the last 10 years, but not this one. And not that this will be greatly different, but I'm looking to look at it a little bit differently this morning. The fact that I want us to see is that there's a difference in the way an English dictionary or a modern dictionary defines the word contentment and what Paul's objective is here in the book of Philippians. The Greek word is autarkēs, and it creates two English words that are almost obsolete. One is autocracy, and the other one is autocratic. And so if you have an older dictionary, I found it interesting, at least one of the dictionaries I looked at no longer even has autocracy in it. Okay? But autocratic is often there, because that word means self-ruled. So an autocratic form of government is one that the ruler creates all the self-rule. He rules on his own. And so the key here is ruling one's self. And that's the difference between the modern use of the word contentment and the biblical use of the word contentment. And the biblical use describes a condition that I think is very important for us in our Christian life. And so in this lesson, that's what I'm going to strive for anyway, is to see that essential difference between the way Paul uses the word and the way we often use it in English. And so when you look at contentment, I'm going to start out negatively. One of the things that you can see as the importance of contentment is what happens when contentment isn't present. What conditions come about by discontent? And there are three that I think are very pertinent for us this morning. First of all, discontentment erodes personal relationships. A discontent person who is not satisfied with their condition often comes to believe that the reason why things aren't the way they ought to be is because of how someone else has failed, or in comparison of themselves to someone else. They may covet what you have, but they do not. Therefore, they get discontent because you have it and they don't. Or they may actually believe that you are the reason that they don't have what you want. And so they get the idea that what you have that they want should have been theirs all along, and because you have it is why they don't have it. Or the reason why they can't have contentment in their life is that you somehow failed to provide them what they needed to be content, to be satisfied. So you find family problems that come from that. Children are not happy, and they think it's because their parents haven't done for them what they think other children's parents are doing. Or husbands or wives become discontent because they don't think their mate is doing what they should have done to make them happy. And so it manifests itself in a couple of different results. Attention is deflected from the one person that is responsible for changing whatever situation you are in that is making you discontent to someone else. Because the only person that can change the way you feel about the circumstances in which you find yourself is you. But you think it's them. And you become discontent with them. It results in people trying to manipulate other people so that they get what they desire. That's a danger in marriages, a manipulative wife or a manipulative husband. Children learn very early how to manipulate their parents to get them to provide what they want. And sometimes that's not really pretty. You've probably, everyone in this room has experienced the child in a store or in a restaurant where you're trying to just, within yourself, have a nice, pleasant meal or whatever. And they're manipulating their parents by pitching a fit to get what they want. And if it were only children that did that, it wouldn't be so bad. But I'm not speaking to children today. I have a couple young people over there. But, you know, I'm more concerned about the adults that do those kind of things to manipulate, because they think it's somebody else's responsibility to make them happy. And within the church, I've had this experience all the years that I have tried to preach, that when you talk to someone who's not as involved or engaged as a active Christian ought to be, very often it's always somebody else's fault. Maybe their husband's in the way, or their wife's in the way, or things aren't going well in the neighborhood or at work, or at church it's the song leader's not any good, the preacher's dull, the friend people aren't friendly. I remember years ago when Brother Benny was still alive, and Benny Boyd and I made an attempt to visit every member of the congregation in their home. We got to almost everybody, couldn't get there. Then on the same night, we sat in two different living rooms, and one person told us the reason why they didn't come as often as we should is because this was the most unfriendly church they'd ever been around. The very next home we went to, the person told us, I just love this church. Everybody is so supportive and so friendly and so loving. And they were talking about the same group of people. Now, who changed from the one living room to the other? You? The church? How did you go from being unfriendly to friendly, unloving to loving, from one living room to the other? It was the individual's approach to their lives as Christians. That's the first problem. The second problem with discontent is it clouds the decision-making process. Now, this is a real-world problem. Discontent often elevates emotion above reason in the decision-making process. This often occurs in financial matters. Debt is a major problem in our society. And of course, we have a government that sets a really good example for us in this. You know, that's kind of sarcasm if you didn't recognize it. But what does advertising do? Advertising tries to create the emotion that you must have this. You may be the ugliest boy in school, but if you get this aftershave, that will change the way the girls feel about you. You may not think you're worth a whole lot, but if you drive this kind of car, everybody will think that that's all about. And so what happens in the process of financial things? Emotion takes over. And people buy what they want that they cannot afford. And that solves all their problems in life. No, it creates more problems. Because now they have debt. And it's not just in financial matters. It's, besides money, the second great decision-making problem that people ever face is the decision of who you're going to marry, or if you're going to marry, who are you going to marry? And in our society, oftentimes the perfect mate is often viewed the same way as the perfect automobile, the perfect home, the perfect job. And emotion overtakes reason. Debbie and I have somebody that's very close to us that has had a horrible marriage experience and gone through a horrible divorce experience. And she's older and wiser than she was when she got married. And she told Debbie not too long ago, I knew he was rotten when I married him, but he was so good looking. Well, you know, I was too when Debbie married me, but now look at me, right? Does that not happen to us all? I hate getting cleaned up in the morning because I look and say, who is the old person in that mirror? Now that's life, right? Why would you make that important of a decision based upon something as frivolous and as subject to change? I remember the old preacher joke. My old friend, preacher friend, told me this a long time ago that he was sitting in his study with a woman who was wanting to leave her husband, and he had performed the marriage. And he said, when we did the wedding, don't you remember me saying, and you promised that you would take him for better or for worse? And he said, Debbie's laughing already because it's an old joke. She told me, yeah, but he was a whole lot worse than I took him for. Yeah, that happens. That happens. And that's the kind of decisions that are made. So it's really no surprise that these problems are not solved by that increases discontent when decisions are driven by emotion. The third thing, and most importantly in terms of this lesson, is discontent distorts a person's view of God. Just as discontentment can cause people to blame other people for the conditions in their lives that they don't like, it often causes people to blame God for the things in their lives that cause them to feel miserable. And you know, we mentioned that one of the things in relationships with people is that people will try to manipulate each other in order to get what they think they want from people, in order to make their lives what it ought to be. Well, those same things work in people's relationships with God. Sometimes people will try to manipulate God. If you will just do this, God, if you'll just... My mother's very sick. If you'll just tell her, I'll go to church all the time. If I'm just well, I've had this experience as a preacher several times in my life, visiting somebody in the hospital that's asked for the preacher to come and visit. And you go, and they've not been a faithful Christian, and they're facing a very critical operation or something. Well, you know, if God will just get me through this, you'll see me every time. And very rarely has it ever happened that the person successfully came through that and they changed anything about the way of their life. These are difficulties, real difficulties that plague people's lives because they are discontent and they try to deal with that from the human emotional standpoint. So what does Paul say about that? Let's look for just a couple minutes here, right back at our text in Philippians chapter 4, verses 10 through 13. Maybe the most important thing is what he says in verse 11. Not that I speak from want, for I have learned to be content in whatever circumstances I am. Contentment is something you learn. It's not something that's natural in human beings. What's natural for us is to want to satisfy our desires. And for us to do whatever we have to do that. And as we've already mentioned, modern advertising recognizes that, and marketing focuses on that very thing, that people will strive to get what they want. Paul affirms here he learned to be content. And I think it's really interesting. The grammar of this statement is interesting. He said he learned it. He used that as a past tense verb. So he had, at the time he wrote this, that was something that he had learned. But it's actually the Greek imperfect tense, which is a past tense that starts in the past and moves forward. So he had learned it, but he was still practicing it. It doesn't really tell us of anything in the process of Paul's life that brought him to this point. It just tells us that the time that he writes the Philippians, he says, I have learned this. I have brought it under control. It is now a practicing part of my life. So I can't really tell from what Paul said exactly when he reached that point. It simply tells me that he did. And the fact of the matter is that we either do what Paul did and we learn to be content, or we will deal with the problems of discontentment that we spent the first part of this lesson on for the rest of our lives. Those things will always be present. The second thing Paul tells us is that contentment overcomes life circumstances. He said, in whatever state I am, I have learned to be content. Now, to the worldly minded and to the modern definition, dictionary definition of contentment, it is the outward circumstances that creates for you contentment. And when you have these circumstances, you don't want them to change. And you just say, I'm content. I can just roll on here. Don't let anybody let this change. And that's the great contrast between the worldly view of contentment and the view Paul gives Christians. If you approach contentment and the achievement of contentment from that world's perspective of life, then you are putting yourself on a roller coaster in which the feeling of contentment will ride up and down the wave of your emotions based upon whatever the circumstances happen to be. And with a couple of exceptions in this room, everybody here has experienced life for a while. And you know that no matter how good your life is, or as far as that goes, however bad it is, life doesn't move like that. It's not a steady state line. The best of lives have some downs that go with their ups, and the worst of lives have some ups that goes with their downs. And if you're going to let that determine your contentment, you are going to be riding a mental, emotional roller coaster every day of your life. But if we learn, like Paul learned, not to let those circumstances affect our outlook on life, we can have the contentment that Paul's talking about. True contentment. Paul says, when I didn't have it, I was content. When I had it in abundance, I was content. When things are going well, I was content. When people were persecuting me, I was content. Now that's the challenge. That doesn't fit the world's concept of contentment. And that's the challenge I certainly face. But the third thing Paul says here for us as Christians to take note of is verse 13, where he says contentment leads the Christian to spiritual victory. He concludes with a very familiar statement, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Now we hear that verse quoted a lot, and it's interesting to me that we often hear this verse quoted as a general affirmation of spiritual victory. I can do all things through him. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do that, and that's certainly so. How often do we apply it to the very life situation in which Paul utters these words, which is dealing with the problems of life, of discontentment and contentment? Paul said it's that ability that he has learned to be content that allows him to be victorious. So how does a Christian learn to be content? I think Paul tells us that in this passage. He says the Christian learns contentment when he learns to rely upon God, no matter what the situation in life he happens to be in. Because just a couple of verses down from what we read at the start of the lesson, in Philippians 4:19, he says, and my God will supply all your needs according to his riches in glory in Christ Jesus. The conclusion that I come to is that Paul learned to be content when he realized that God was the one who would provide him what he really needed. And the promise of conquering with Christ includes every aspect of our lives as Christians. It includes our family life, it includes our workday life in the world in which we live, it includes our neighbors, includes our our church family. It includes our goals in this life to reach the next life. So that leaves us just something I want to deal with just a couple minutes and then we'll be done. And that is, how do we achieve the sense of contentment that Paul expressed in this passage? How can I get that in my own life? A couple of things. First, we have to convince ourselves and come to a realization that contentment issues from our inner self, not from our outward circumstances. I think we could recognize this, two things, if we want to, and secondly, if we just stop and think about it. How much of your life, the circumstances around your life, can you control? It's just a little bit of it, isn't it? We can exercise a little bit of control over our habits, over our diet, even though we don't want to, over how much exercise we get. If we're really strong, we can exercise control over our budget to a certain extent. We make a choice of where we live, how we're going to earn our living, so forth. But those choices we make do not control absolutely all the exterior aspects of our life. Physically fit, healthy people still get injured in accidents or contract horrible diseases. I still remember when Debbie and I were fairly newlywed and we lived in Louisville, Kentucky. There was a person that wrote physical fitness column in the Louisville Courier Journal. And there's now a tennis center named after him because he died of a heart attack while playing tennis. Mr. Physical Fitness. Now, true, if you don't take care of yourself, that will cause more problems for you. But physically fit people, you know. I don't know if you call them physically fit. Some of the road workers that I see on the highways look like they also spend a lot of time in the neighborhood tavern and things like that. But they do manual work and they lift things and they're strong things and they're the workers. And you could be working on a bridge in Baltimore and you could be one of those fellows that could carry a couple hundred pounds without thinking about it. And just like that, right? This week, you're gone. Do you know anybody, maybe yourself, me, who ended up with a career in some other field than the one in which they got their degree? Or the thing they always thought they wanted to be? Why? How's that happen? Well, you don't always have the choice of where you're going to work or how you're going to make your living. All those kind of things happen. And they're all the outward things. And it doesn't matter who you are or where you are, those things can happen to you. And so Paul distinguished the outer circumstances from the spiritual reality. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 8, he said, "We are afflicted in every way, but we're not crushed. Perplexed, but not despairing. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our body." He said, "I experience these things, but they don't destroy me. They don't even define who he is." Because he said, "I carry the life of Jesus. His inner faith was what controlled his manner of life, not the external circumstances that he faced at any particular time or point of that life. The second important point about learning about contentment, and I always think of Brother Bragg when I say something like this, is to distinguish between our needs from our wants. He always heard him say more than once in the jewelry business, he was in a want business, not a need business. Now, the advertisers will convince you you can't marry a woman unless you do go to a jeweler and find her a very nice diamond. But that's not so. There's probably been a number of really good marriages in life that started at a pawn shop somewhere. But as we mentioned earlier, one of the things discontentment does is it distorts the decisions we make. And Paul understood that his contentment came from the fact that he was supplied his needs. And he knew the difference between his needs and his wants. Philippians 4 and verse 19, "And my God will supply all your needs," we've already read this once, "according to his riches in glory in Christ Jesus." And so often when even you talk to Christians who are disappointed not in life, they're disappointed because they haven't gotten some of the things they want. And I know I've told you about this more than once because I've been here too long, long, long time. When Debbie and I lived in Hobart, Indiana, one of the ladies there had a house fire, and that was years before our house fire. And I went to try to talk to her, and she was distraught. She said, "You know, David said he never saw a saint beg for bread, and we say Paul says he will supply all my needs in my house." And the time when she was telling me that, it was still smoking and burning, and there were things thrown out. You know how they do it. Throw things out of the house and all that. But at the same time, people from church were bringing her clothes and her food and whatever. And she said, "God said he would supply that." And I told her, "Look, he is. He is." But you think about all those things that you have accumulated that you want, and those really, your life will go on without them. You just don't realize that. But here's the real danger about that. The failure to distinguish our needs from our wants may not just rob us of contentment in this life, it could also cost us our salvation. Listen to what Paul says in 1 Timothy chapter 6. "For we have brought nothing into the world, so we cannot take anything out of it either. If we have food and covering, with these we shall be content. But those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare, and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all sorts of evil, and some by longing for it have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." Paul says, that can cause you to lose your soul. So we need to come to understand ultimately that how do I become and achieve contentment is that it's a matter of learning to trust God. Paul said this twice in the text that we looked at this morning. "I can do all things through him who strengthens me. My God will supply all your needs according to his riches and glory in Jesus Christ." And so the ultimate question is, I am a believer in God. And I know you're a believer. And I'm a believer in the sense maybe that many in the religious world aren't, because we believe to the extent that when Jesus said, "He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved," we believe that to the extent that we do it. We believe we're here now, worshiping, trying to learn, trying to encourage one another. But this is the thing that as I was reading and thinking about this, what brought on a fourth lesson about contentment is, do I believe this? As a Christian, do I really believe this? That's the source of contentment. That I trust God that He will keep His promise to provide me what I need. Paul learned to be content. And I need to be challenged. And I assume that all of us do, to learn to be content in our own lives. Remember, God promises that it will be worth it. Godliness actually is a means of great gain when it's accompanied with godliness, with contentment, excuse me. If you get your songbooks out, we'll sing the song of encouragement. I hope we're all encouraged to strive in our own lives to find the level of contentment that the Apostle Paul had. If there's one in the audience this morning who has never obeyed the gospel, is ready to find that peace that comes with knowing Jesus and trusting in God, we invite you to come while we stand and while we sing.